are listening to Justice Radio on WMPG. This is the monthly Youth Justice segment with the Young People's Caucus and your hosts, Liv and Swathi. Today is the second half of a two-part series with Brandon Brown about revisioning conflict narratives. In the first part of our conversation, we talked about the arc and movement of conflict as we are socialized to see it, living in a divisive world, and how we dream of moving to a place where we respond to hurt with love. You can listen back to that episode by finding Revisioning Conflict Narratives with Brandon Brown on the Justice Radio feed. In today's part two, we will explore the pre-work of restorative justice, what accountability can really mean, and how little our current carceral system meaningfully supports those accused of crimes and also the victims of crimes. And with that, we'll get into our convo with Brandon Brown, the Executive Director of Youth-Led Justice, a loving father, and committed activist. Okay, I have two threads. One, you talked about the pre-work as part of like the rise in the arc. Can you talk a little more about that pre-work? Because I feel like it's connected to how we define restorative justice and how we talk about conflict and harm and repair differently and through restorative justice.
Yeah, so I've never said this before. I don't even think I've ever thought it before until this conversation, but I'm going to say that there's two types of pre-work in this world. The first type of pre-work is pre-conflict, right? Which is just what we teach each other.
Yeah.
Right? Like how to treat each other. And so like conflict occurs at such high frequencies in our society because we have taught each other that like it's okay to act certain ways, like to lash out, to act with violence, to be mean. That's all normal stuff in our society. And so the pre-work that's happening before conflict is just social norms, right? When a conflict occurs, the pre-work that restorative justice focuses on is accountability. So if the big picture or the goal of restorative justice, which in most places and circles it is to have some type of restorative meeting, usually called a circle, where people can be heard, be cared for, like people, every stakeholder in harm, and where accountability can be expressed and where an actual resolution can be created, right? The pre-work is everything that happens before that concluding event, which we call a circle, right? Mm-hmm. For me, pre-work is all about accountability. Right. It's all about accountability for everybody involved. And so a lot of times people frame accountability just under the light of like what you're personal, like what you're personally accountable to. So, OK, I punched somebody at school. Most people would think my accountability is just about taking the responsibility for punching that person. Right. And saying I was wrong for that. I shouldn't have done it. And then being able to like adequately express why I shouldn't have done it and why I understand that it was harmful. At Youth-Led Justice, for me personally as well, and for a lot of people that do this work, accountability is so much bigger than that. You also have to teach people what they're not accountable for. And the reality is that if you believe the expression hurt people, then that means that you have to bring somebody to a point of accountability where they can take accountability for who they hurt and they can give away the accountability for who hurt them, right? Too often in our society, and it doesn't matter if you're four or you're 40, we blame ourselves for the people and the things that have hurt us. I should have done this different. I should have done this better. I shouldn't have been in this situation. That is not yours to take most of the time. So for us, a journey of accountability actually is about releasing and accepting. I release what was done to me that was out of my control. And I understand, I come to an understanding that somebody else is accountable for that and that I was a victim or I was a survivor. And then we lead people to the journey of sometimes because of what you've been through that made this conflict possible. So if I grew up in a household where violence was normal, of course I'm gonna be violent at some point in my life. I am not to blame for everything that preceded my violent act. I take accountability for what I did through understanding what was done to me was not a choice that I made, right? So for us, that's how you define pre-work, right? It's not just about, too often in the field of restorative justice, we say, this is the one isolated incident that we're working on. There was a fight at school. We're going to talk about what happened that day. You cannot talk about what happened that day if somebody is suffering from 15 years of something else that led up to that day. So for us, the pre-work is so much bigger. It's so much more in depth, right? For me and my definition of restorative justice, I think you spend 80% of the time unpacking what happened to somebody in life and 20% of the time unpacking what happened to them that day. Right. And unpacking what they did, because if they cannot understand, like, I'll just use myself as an example. I committed a violent crime when I was 21 years old, and I didn't actually take responsibility for the crime or accept the accountability that was necessary until many years after the crime, when I actually realized I had been hurt continuously in my life before that crime ever happened. So for me, violence was a possibility because I had become so accustomed to violence in all of its forms, including structural, including emotional, right, including physical. And so I only ever transformed my life through the harm that I committed when I was able to release responsibility for the harms that were committed to me. And so that is restorative justice to me, right? It's the journey that we take to get people to understand social norms, structural violence, and things that they are not responsible for before we ever even do the work of what they are responsible for.
Yeah, I feel like I've never heard it quite that way, Brennan, and it makes so much sense. And it's like accountability then is like accountability to change, right? Because then, like, what all of that work, understanding who and what has harmed you in the past and what you're not accountable for, and moving through that and healing from that, is what actually allows you to change. And now you are accountable to doing it different going forward, which is not the way that we talk about accountability, really.
I mean, to the point that you just made, one of the things that we really have to start teaching people, because this conversation is huge, right? This conversation applies to every single facet of daily life, from how we treat ourselves to how we treat our intimate community to how we treat our wider community to how we envision people we've never met or conceived. Like we can bring this out all the way, or we can bring it in all the way. But if we're just talking about schools and we're just talking about communities, my biggest gripe with our systems and our structures and the way that we use punishment is that the punishment we dole out assumes that everybody has a good experience. So we assume in schools, through all of our punishment policies, right, whether it's something so small as like sending a kid to the principal's office, like, because that's a display of authority. Right. And it's a reprimand that, like, if you ever got sent to the principal's office, you might have like boasted in the moment to your peers, like, oh, I'm going to the principal's office again. But during that walk, you were like, oh, ish. Right. I'm about to see the principal. This highly authoritative figure. Right. So whether we're talking about that, or we're talking about detention, or we're talking about suspension or expulsion, the quickness to punish assumes that every person we punish is the same. And that they grew up in an environment where they learned all the same things. They processed information the same ways. They had the same opportunities. The reality is, for a kid who grew up in a two-parent household, you know, that was in the financial 2% of earners and had access to food and technology and transportation, and also lived in a peaceful environment, right? How that young person responds to something is a lot different than the young person who grew up in a one-parent household where there was domestic violence present, where there was drugs present, where there was horrible poverty and not a lot of opportunity for food and sustenance and all these things, right? So we're talking about two opposite ends of the spectrum there, but the spectrum exists. And so punishment assumes that those two opposite ends of the spectrum are the same.
Yeah.
They are not, right? You cannot punish those two kids the same. And schools have one method of punishment that is supposed to be equal.
Yeah.
And here's the horrible irony about our world. We talk about equity we talk about equity all the time. We only see equity in the negative, in punishment, mm-hmm. right? And that's subjective too. We don't always see equity. A lot of times we see the kid who was the disadvantaged one with the whole world stacked against him punished more for the same thing as the young person who had every opportunity to learn and have sustenance and all that. But the point that I'm trying to make is that punishment assumes that we have a peaceful, consistent world.
Mm-hmm.
We do not. And that's why punishment will never work. Right. That's why, because no matter where somebody is out on the spectrum, what they need is the same. They need their needs met. They need to learn. They need to understand, and they need to be loved. Right. Not in a corny way. They need to be loved in a way that teaches them.
Yeah.
Right. That pays attention to them, that asks them what they need. And if you ask either, no matter where somebody lies on the spectrum, if you ask them what they need, they will tell you. Punishment does not ask that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so we never actually resolve conflict because we never meet people's needs. And that's one of the things that's just ironic to me about the normalization of like carceral realities and punishment as a mechanism to transform is it assumes that everybody's the same. And we know that we are not.
Yeah. I mean, we were thinking a little bit about themes that came out of our last conversation with YPC youth before we came into this. And one of the biggest themes that came out was their struggle with one size fits all discipline in schools. And they each had a story of it, you know? And that tees up, you know, if you want to have another conversation at some point. I feel like, because I feel like that gets us to, what a perfect way to get us to like, okay, school in schools and communities, what could it look like to actually have in that sort of individualized response and the skills going into a conflict because you've like learned about conflict and healing in a different way. Okay. So anyway, that brings us, I think, to like the next phase of this conversation that I'd be really excited to have.
Well, also like off script,
I mean, we could just use this for like our own like note taking too, and to think about if we want to have a part two to this conversation. Is Swathi and I were at the state house talking about YPC last week, and this one legislator, do you know like his words or what he said? But Swathi had to respond to him because
he basically, I don't remember his exact words, but he was like, I want to know what you all are doing for the victims because we are not, because we were talking about our work with young people who have caused harm. And I want to know what you're doing for the victims. And we don't talk about the victims enough.
Yeah.
We're never talking about the victims. That's like literally what he said. And of course we were like, and it took us a minute to get there because it was like, how did you even have this question in response to our presentation? But we were like, the young people we're talking about are so often selves. So like, I don't know why you're drawing this like distinction here.
It's about division.
Yeah. It's connected to what Liv was like, that arc that y'all are talking about and like the clarity that people want to be able to have.
Yeah. And people in power are also part of the reason they're in power is because they have knowledge. And one of the things that they have knowledge about in our divisive world is what's the question that I can ask that immediately separates.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to tell you, I deal with this all the time in the work that I do, right? Not just in the work I do with youth, but in all the work I do, because I do a lot of different things. And that question comes up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the only response that's adequate for me is actually not an answer, it's a question, and it's, what are you doing for the victims?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You are listening to Justice Radio with Liv and Swathi, and our guest, Brandon Brown. Now back to our conversation.
So when I talk about restorative justice, so like, you know, maybe this is something that makes it in, maybe it's not. You know, like this year I'm a George Soros Justice Fellow, right? Like the biggest thing that's ever happened to me in my life, I got funding to build something through the Soros Foundation, you know?
Yeah.
And what we're building is diversion just like we do for youth, but for adults and only in cases of violence. Mm-hmm. We will not accept a diversion case if it is not violent. Mm-hmm. So we're working with DAs in two counties in Maine to give us referrals for somebody that has committed a violent act, and we will do a 12 to 16 month diversion process with them that is victim centered, right? That primarily aims to meet the survivor's needs. And that's how we work through accountability based on the needs of the survivor and what I just went on my spiel about what the pre-work looks like, right? Like making both parties understand that the system that you could be in, if not for this diversion, is only designed to harm both of you, right? So what I ask when people say, how does restorative justice meet the needs of victims? Or how, or like, what about the victims? What about, I say, what do you do for them? And I would have asked that person, I'm assuming it was a man, because it sounds like a question a man would ask, right?
Yes, it was.
You know, what I would have asked is just straight to him, what do you do for victims? Simple as that. Like, how I will answer your question if you answer it first. What do you personally do for victims of crime? Because we love shifting the onus of responsibility to everybody else. And we love believing that our system actually does something for victims. I'll tell you a little story, very, very quick one, about the crime I committed. What they did for my victim is they made him believe that he needed to come and relive all of his trauma on the stand and be subjected to questions from my attorney that made him look like the bad guy and that was somehow going to heal him. Right. And you know what's super ironic when people say to me, what are you doing for victims? Is I say, well, I'm not. What I'm doing for victims is listening to them, primarily not telling them anything. I'm listening to them because I don't know what they need unless I hear them. I can't tell them what they need because I'm not them. Right. But the irony that nobody ever thought of is after I was found guilty and given a 17-year prison sentence, you know what the prison provided me? Every day of my life for the 13 years that I was involved in it, 3 meals a day, free hot water, free heat. You know, like, I'm not trying to minimize the experience of being in prison. It was horrific and I hated everything about it. But my basic human needs were provided to me by the very system that met none of my victims. So the day I was found guilty and the day I was sentenced, my victim was kicked out of the courtroom. And how many times do you think a district attorney or a police officer or any system stakeholder followed up with him and said, what do you need? It didn't happen. But you know what they did do? They called him every time that my name came up in a press article. They called him every time that I was up for any type of decision about my probation. Even when he said, please stop calling me, I do not care, they still called him. So we live in a society that has normalized a system that actually accepts causing victims repeated harm, not doing anything to facilitate their healing. So when somebody says, what do you do for victims? I say, a lot more than you. That's what I do.
Well, and telling them it's justice. And that cognitive dissonance must be so, is so awful. It's so awful and harmful.
And I just want to like give like words to what you're just talking about is like the system is re-traumatizing and exploiting victims to profit off of putting people into its system.
It's not even just re-traumatizing, right? Which it is 100% because it's traumatizing. So like it's it's worse than re-traumatizing because we're making you live your trauma that's already occurred in a newly traumatic environment. So it's compounding trauma, and it's and like we again, I go back to what we kind of started with, which is this normalization of division, right? This normalization of winning and losing, and this normalization of punishment because we assume everybody's the same, as being the reason why we accept a system that if you just took 5 minutes to actually look at, you would see this is harmful, more so to victims than anybody else. And so that's the part that's crazy. And it's from the narrative perspective, we have become so brainwashed by the system because it's just what we've always done that we're scared to think of a new possibility. Because literally from the time that I was young,
yeah,
I believed bad guys went to prison and good guys did not. To the point the day before I committed my crime, I believed bad guys went to prison, mm-hmm, good guys did not.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine my shock when I was told I was going to spend 17 years in prison. I'm a good person,
mm-hmm,
but I made a terrible decision. But I had a lot of learning to do, and that's what prison doesn't teach you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just... We don't talk about that person asking that question. What are you doing for the victims? It's like a narrative hijack,
yeah,
right? Because what it does is it draws on a master script,
yeah,
that our system cares about victims, even though that is not the reality.
Yeah.
So it shuts down the conversation completely.
Yeah.
But, or it opens up the conversation to say, what does our system do for them currently? You know, even like this, you know, it's always a struggle to say this because there's really good people doing victims advocate work, but like victims advocacy organizations, just as parts of the system, are not doing anything for victims either. Right. They're telling victims who they have to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they might, and they have funding to do things for victims, but it just pays people salary. It doesn't help them meet their needs.
Yeah.
And the reality is most people who are victims in our society, guess who they are? They're also from the same communities as, mm-hmm, the perpetrators. They're, mm-hmm, also poor. A lot of times they're minorities.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times they've been subjected to violence throughout their life. Mm-hmm. And so like resources is what they need, mm-hmm, not justice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We should deliver justice through resources,
mm-hmm,
and through accountability and through healing.
Mm-hmm.
Those should be the measurements, not punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes so much sense as part of the reason why this system has stuck like this for so, well, was made in the first place, is because the people in power are mostly not those people. They mostly haven't been perfect or victims in like their own lived expertise and don't, you know, like don't recognize how little we're actually helping and supporting victims.
Mm-hmm. And they have privilege and resources to move through the system with more ease.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, educated.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest irony about like that people struggle to talk about is if you actually trace the roots of crime and punishment, you're not going to like where you end up if you go backwards. Yeah. Right. And it's like, because it's scary and it makes you feel like you've participated in something that is, yeah, sinister.
Yeah.
And you know, we've put it on the moral binary, this idea of crime,
yeah,
but like crime didn't start with morals. Crime started with race.
Yeah.
That's just the reality of it. You know, the vast majority of our laws, way before they ever became about morals, were about race.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We criminalized blackness hundreds of years ago, and it's still the worst crime that you can commit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if you're black and you commit a crime, statistically, you're way worse off than any other demographic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just history repeating itself. And it's not to say that we don't need justice and we don't need accountability. We do. Bad things happen in this country, but the reason they happen so frequently and so much more than any other country,
mm-hmm,
is because we've normalized punishment, re-traumatization,
mm-hmm,
and this, mm-hmm, idea of accountability through hurting each other.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when somebody says something mean to me as a young person, like, I don't care where the young person comes from. You find me a 12-year-old or a 10-year-old who somebody said something super mean to, who their first instinct wasn't, I should punch this kid, right? Some kids are, you know, have grown up in an environment that teaches them, let's identify where those feelings come from and let's work through them in the moment. But I don't care who you are. 99% of American youth, the first thing they think is I should punch this person.
Yeah. Or they internalize it.
Yeah.
They take responsibility for, yeah, that.
And then I think, yeah, still think I should punch this person,
yeah, yeah,
or bite them or, yeah, kick them or hurt them.
Yeah.
Because that's what we've seen our whole lives. We've seen the systems do it. We've seen each other do it. We, you know, it's like,
yeah,
you know, I'm kind of going off track a little bit, which is okay, but
yeah.
It's just...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I wanted to close with a question, which is, yeah, we want these monthly episodes to sort of be a conversation between folks who are working in the youth justice space and then young people. Mm. And so to that end, what are three questions you have for YPC youth?
Yeah. Ooh, that's a big one. One question I would have for YPC youth is, oh man, this is a hard one. I have like a million. One question I would have is, who should have power? Mm. Right? And it's very subjective, but just who should have power? And I'd be interested to hear, you know, what the youth have to say. Another one would be a very like more of a personal question, which is, have you ever hurt anybody? And why, right? And then the third question I would say is, who have you learned the most from in your life? Mm. Right? And, you know, what about them made you want to learn, right? Because I think you have to want to learn to truly learn. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I won't talk about why I would ask those questions so much. Maybe after the response I can say that.
Yeah. I love those. Thank you, Brandon, so much. Really, thank you for this conversation and for what feels like a really generous start to many more conversations.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I feel like I learned more through this conversation than I have in as long as I can remember.
Yay! That's the best feeling.
Yeah, we don't get to talk about these things enough, mm-hmm. you know. I had a really good session with Esme, too. We were talking about a lot of this because of one of her cases. Mm. And I was just like, let's just work it out.
Yeah.
Let's figure it out.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Justice Radio. We invite you to continue these kinds of conversations with us through our Instagram, @YPCMaine, where an amazing group of youth leaders post about policy, culture, and opportunities in change-making spaces. Please feel free to DM us with suggestions for what you would like to hear on this podcast, or if you would like to join us for a conversation. And if you're a young person tuning in, we would love to hear your responses to Brandon's closing questions. Who should have power? Have you ever hurt anybody and why? Who have you learned the most from in your life? And what about them made you want to learn? And if you've got something that you want to share, DM us. We're here for all of it. And finally, a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series.